All right, welcome to the Indiana Wildlife Federation podcast. My name is Quentin Collins, and I will be your host for this series. I have been on the board of directors for the Indiana Wildlife Federation since 2019, and I've served on a number of their committees, from the policy committee to the governance committee, and have certainly enjoyed my time with IWF and look back fondly at reading Ranger Rick magazines in the doctor's office when I was a kid that are parent organization, National Wildlife Federation, puts out. We wanted to start this podcast series as a way to, provide some content for our members and our constituency, and, just kind of share some information, about conservation issues that have come into the light and conservation issues that just may be of interest to our members. Throughout this series, we're going to be sitting down with folks who have our mission truly at heart. From conservation leaders to wildlife experts, we'll take a deeper look at all kinds of issues related to protecting the environment that we love, and I'm more than confident that we're going to learn a thing or two along the way. We are excited today to have you join us as we sit down with our first guest, fellow board member John Goss. John, thanks for coming out here. How are you doing?
Great. Good to be here.
Well, awesome. Awesome. Well, hey, just to get us started, can you tell me a little bit about, your conservation background and kind of how you became involved with IWF?
I'd say it goes all the way back to growing up in a family that liked to camp, fish. We had beagle, rabbit dogs, liked to be outdoors. Boy Scouts helped me get some of my early conservation values, I think. And then when I went to school in Bloomington, some friends and I put together the first recycling program. So learned how to, organize and get people involved and do things in an early age.
Well, good stuff, John. And tell me about a little bit about how your, career in conservation has kind of came into fruition and, how you kind of moved through various jobs and in your past life. I certainly know that one of your most famous positions, I guess I could say, would be when you were appointed as the Asian carp czar under the Obama administration.
Yeah, let me just quickly go through. In Bloomington, I served on the Parks Board, and that got me exposed to a lot of things about maintenance and outdoor recreation things. Then my job in Indianapolis following that was with Lieutenant Governor Frank O'Bannon. And I was appointed to the DNR Commission and served on the DNR Commission for about 12 years. And that's the policy-making group for
Absolutely.
Department of Natural Resources. I then became DNR director. Governor O'Bannon appointed me DNR director. Dream job for anybody who likes the outdoors. Had a great experience, a lot of fun working with all the different there's more than 20 different divisions in all kinds of natural resources management roles. And after DNR is when I got connected with IWF.
Okay.
I became a board member, and our director our director left, and I became the executive director. So then I had another dream semi-retired job. And enjoyed that for a few years. Got involved with the Asian carp invasion with the other wildlife federations around the Great Lakes. And our group sent a letter to President Obama and said, you need to put somebody in charge to organize this Asian carp control program. Turns out the president's office said, well, you got anybody to recommend? And I volunteered, and I was selected.
Well, I guess that's one way to become an appointee, huh? You just got to suggest yourself or appoint yourself and just get a rubber stamp, right?
Very unusual. Very unusual.
That is awesome. And then, heck, I know after that, I guess you just couldn't get enough of us, and you've come back to join us on the board. Can you remind me of when you recently joined us? I know it's been
right
within the last year or so, right?
Right. I became fully retired in 2019, so I've been on IWF board now for a little over a year. And another break in my career, I just got elected to the National Wildlife Federation board to represent Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois. So I'm involved with NWF policymaking now too.
Man, well, that is absolutely awesome, and I know we are certainly very fortunate to have you as our regional representative. And for those that may not be familiar, Indiana Wildlife Federation is just one of the many organizations that is kind of encapsulated underneath the umbrella of the National Wildlife Federation. And the National Wildlife Federation has various regions, and those regions will select a board member from the affiliate organizations. And John has been, I guess the more correct thing to say is that we are lucky enough to have John as our regional representative, and we're very confident that he's going to do a great job. Moving into the kind of today's topic, we're going to be talking about invasive carp. Obviously, John is kind of one of the foremost authorities in the invasive carp problem, and most people that are involved in the outdoors know that they have permeated our waterways in a way that's been quite detrimental, oftentimes to native fish populations, and even impacting the local economy. So, John, can you first just tell me, you know, I know the term Asian carp kind of encapsulates a few different kind of subspecies. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Asian carp is a kind of a generic term for four different types of fish that originated in Asia. The bighead carp, the silver carp, the grass carp, and the black carp. So Indiana has bighead and silvers and grass carp. We haven't seen or found any black carp so far. But certainly they are not anything like the native common carp that came from Europe. Sometimes they're called German carp. Mm-hmm. And so the common carp that we have are very different species. All of these Asian carp are filter feeders. They are eating plankton. So they are competing in the food chain, the food web, with all of our native fish. That's the basic problem. They eat more, they grow faster, they reproduce three or four or five times faster than any of our native species. So that is the threat. And in many of our rivers, including White River, Wabash River, we have in sections, more than 50% of the fish mass are now invasive carp.
My gosh. So I guess that would beg the question then. So how did they originally get here?
Yeah. It was for a good reason, believe it or not.
All right. Just tell me.
Here's the story. Going back to the time frame, Rachel Carson was the author of Silent Spring. And that was a big eye-opener on the dangers of chemicals in our waters. And a big concern for federal and state natural resources people, how do we do weed control and other things without dumping so many chemicals into the water? That's where they came up with the idea of importing fish who love to eat algae, weeds, grass carp especially, eat those, and then bighead and silvers also help take the nutrients out that feed all of the algae and so forth. So by putting bighead and silver carp into an aquaculture, a fish farm pond, you can stop using the chemicals. The fish will help control the algae and weed growth.
So then it sounds like kind of the, I guess, their roots as far as getting introduced to the United States, I guess we're well intentioned. So then,
yes.
So then, of course, I guess the natural question after that would be, how did they get into these waterways and you know, start spreading in such, you know, a precipitous manner?
So first, there were two things. They didn't want to just bring all those fish in. They were actually raising fish in controlled environments, and they were sterilized. So there's a process in which they thought they had, and still believe, that 99% of the fish that were placed into those ponds were sterile, could not reproduce. However, when flooding has occurred in the Mississippi-Missouri basin, and a lot of those fish farms are right along rivers, those fish escaped into the river system. Those very low numbers of fertile fish started finding each other and started reproducing. So we went from a very low percentage chance that there could be a problem to what has now become a population that has exploded in the Mississippi River Basin and is spreading all across the country.
Got it. So I guess where were the initial roots then, as far as, you know, I guess where this problem originated and, you know, how is it kind of, you know, if you were looking at a map of the United States, how has it kind of spread across the United States and, you know, more particularly kind of in the Midwest? I have to imagine that, you know, with river systems being connected to the Great Lakes, that has to be a big concern. You know, what can you tell me about that?
Aquaculture for these kind of fish farms were primarily in Arkansas, Missouri, that area of Mississippi. So once they got into the river system, within about 5 years, they started showing up in the Illinois River, in the Ohio River, and moving up the Mississippi and the Missouri systems. Then within 10 years, they were knocking on the door at Chicago. They were, in the Wabash. They were moving up towards Wisconsin and Minnesota in the Mississippi system. And sport fishermen started really paying attention to the threat that these fish were bringing, because they would out-eat our native fish. So they don't eat native fish or eat their young or anything. They just eat the food supply. So our native fish are going to grow less, reproduce less, and the numbers are going to go down.
Got it. Okay, so... all right. So then, you know, what kind of mitigation efforts have we taken? You know, I imagine that you were involved in some of those discussions in your position under the Obama administration. What are some of the different methods that, you know, we've attempted? What have been kind of the more or less effective ones? And, you know, what do you kind of see as the solution moving forward, per se?
First, let me give you a little more background. There was a court case in which five states had sued Chicago and the Corps of Engineers to close the Chicago Ship Canal and the lock system so that those fish could not swim into Lake Michigan from the Illinois River. And that court case is what precipitated, you know, the involvement of, you know, presidential level concern. And then from that, they directed U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Geological Survey, and any other related federal staff people to make this a top priority. So fortunately, when I came into the picture to be the coordinator of the plan, developing the plan, there was already a directive that it's all hands on board, assign some of your best people, and we need to find a control plan for these fish.
Okay, so then... When you kind of hear about that level of response, particularly from a federal government in response to a case that I guess seems relatively localized in the sense that, you know, it's seemingly only affecting the Midwest region, you know, I have to imagine, and perhaps this is a skeptic in me, but I have to imagine there's some dollars and cents that are being threatened there, by this species. So, how is this fish and, you know, how it's kind of, you know, spread throughout the Midwest and, you know, other waterways? How has that kind of affected the economy, particularly, you know, I know you talked about Chicago, so I would assume the Great Lakes are of great concern there.
So if you think about the river systems, the Mississippi, Illinois River, Ohio, Missouri, sport fishing is not that big on those river systems. There is some sport fishing, but it's not a big industry. Mm-hmm. So the communities and the sport fishermen were not as organized and, you know, outraged by the threat of these invasive carp. But when it was knocking at the door of getting into Lake Michigan and spreading through the Great Lakes, all of those communities became united. They came up in arms saying there absolutely must be a coordinated state and federal effort to get a control plan. And that's what has happened. We were able to, you know, get all the agencies contributed, the state's DNR, fish biologists involved, and everyone involved. And the conclusion was we needed a barrier system. We needed to keep these fish contained with a barrier system.
So what kind of barrier systems are used?
In Chicago, the Corps of Engineers had already created an experimental electric fish barrier. And actually, it was designed originally to keep the round gobies from escaping out of Lake Michigan into the Mississippi basin. So this experimental barrier seemed to be doing its job. No fish were passing through either way. So we upped the design, basically tripled the size and the strength of the electric field, and started checking for any fish passage. And in fact, you know, in a couple of years, no fish were detected having passed through. So the electric barriers work, but and boats and barges can pass through an electric barrier, but no native fish or invasive fish and other species have difficulty passing through.
So how does the barrier, I guess, know what is kind of, it's targeted fish versus non-targeted fish? You have to tune it for the specific fish?
No, that's not how it works. It stuns everything.
Oh, okay.
So they just can't swim through several hundred feet of electricity field in the water. So that means they can't get all the way through. They are stunned and they just drift back with the current back downstream. So that was the original barrier technology. The barge industry, the pleasure boaters and so forth who have had to pass through that electric field have been very concerned. And you can imagine, because the Coast Guard has always said, if any human went into that area in the barrier or around the barrier, there's no rescue. They're done.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. And that, I'm not going to lie. I was kind of assuming that it was going to be like, you know, a relatively low frequency.
No, no.
So this is a no swimming zone.
This is a no nothing.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Okay. So we've talked about then about kind of, I guess we could call it an electric fence per se.
It is, in fact, an electric fence.
So what are kind of some of the other methods?
There have been other technologies developed then in the last 10 years, and they're being implemented now at Lake Barkley and looking at locations on the Mississippi River. Excuse me. The other technologies include bubble curtains. So they found that fish do not like to swim through a constant air bubble curtain.
Mm-hmm.
Sound, so there are certain frequencies that repel fish from coming into an area, and also flashing lights. So what has been affectionately called the disco barrier was developed with combining all of these, and it is now in place and has been functioning for about 2 years at the lock and dam at Lake Barkley to keep invasive carp from getting up into the Tennessee Valley Authority network, the Tennessee River system.
And has that kind of ladder approach with, the disco ball approach, has that proven to be more or less effective than the electric barrier?
It's a little less than a pure electricity.
Okay.
To be safe, they're saying it's 95% effective. What they believe, though, is that it's turning back enough fish that then with commercial fishing in the area where the fish had already gotten in, they're going to take the population down by large net commercial fishing and to try to capture as many fish as possible to control the population.
Got it. So then if there's commercial fishermen, I guess, that are willing to come and kind of sweep up these fish that have kind of swept back downstream, what's kind of what's their end game? You know, obviously, it sounds like there's money to be made, but I guess the natural question is, what is made out of these carp?
Okay, invasive carp are actually a very good food fish. In China, they're a prized delicacy. If caught in the wild, they're considered, top of the line fish. It's white meat. It's low fat, good in all the omegas and the good fish oils. Because it's low fat, it doesn't retain heavy metals. Therefore, compared to most other wild-caught fish, it has even lower concentrations of negative things in their bodies. So it's a good food fish. However, it is very bony. So you cannot fillet them and have, nice chunks of fillets, but you can get the meat off the bones and then process that into other, like, fish patties or soups or whatever. So,
oh, wow. Okay. Well, yeah. And certainly, you know, just, you know, kind of by my own personal observation, you know, and kind of American culinary culture, we certainly aren't very big in bone-in fish, but I know that we are relatively unique in that regard, and that most other nations have absolutely no problem kind of eating around the bones. And I know I certainly have no problem doing so myself whenever I do go out and take a fish home or something like that. So, you know, again, you know, we've kind of talked about how these fish have kind of, you know, impacted, you know, our native species and, you know, even the economy, and, you know, how it's kind of, you know, provided almost a new industry in the sense that, you know, some people are able to take these fish and presumably are they exporting into the international markets?
There is some export, but that hasn't taken off. There are, in fact, some Chinese investments, even in the Kentucky, Tennessee area, for fish processors to export this back to the market where it's very popular. In the U.S., we don't eat carp. As you know, carp is not a food fish to us. So there's a problem with the name carp. Okay. State of Illinois and U.S. Fish and Wildlife and other groups have been working on this for several years. They're going to rename these fish, and they probably will be sometime in the next year, they'll be announcing a new name. You may or may not know that Orange Ruffy used to be Patagonian toothfish.
Huh. Okay. So just change the name. It sounds a little bit more tasty.
Completely change the name.
Okay.
Down in Louisiana, they have renamed them to Silverfin. So there's a chef who has started a whole processing project down there, and they're calling it Silverfin. That's a possibility, but not sure what name is going to be selected.
Man, my gosh. Well, yeah, that certainly sounds, you know, just a small vernacular change can, you know, certainly make the difference sometime. So
it needs a new chance as a healthy, you know, white meat fish that everyone can, you know, make into fish tacos or whatever.
So. Then I have to ask, have you ever tried carp?
Absolutely.
You have?
Actually, regular carp or invasive. Invasive is tasty.
Really?
In fact, you'd be shocked if you eat, let's say, catfish nuggets and chunks of invasive carp, deep fried. You would probably choose the invasive carp as a milder, more pleasant tasting fish than just the typical catfish that we eat all the time.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, I've never tried carp or anything, but that being said, if and when the opportunity presents itself, I may have to try it then. You know, certainly sounds like, you know, our neighbors over the pond, you know, certainly eat carp really regularly. So it'd be neat to kind of see what that's like.
And in fact, at the state fair near the fish pond, used to do invasive carp tasting with fried Asian carp at the state fair. Not doing it anymore, but we were working on getting people to try it. And people did say, that's great.
Man, that is absolutely wild. Well, and then speaking of carp being in Indiana, you know, as far as Indiana specifically, you know, with most of our listeners presumably being within the state, you know, what are kind of some of the waterways that have been, you know, more or less affected? I certainly know when I'm on social media, on fishing groups or something like that, I see people all the time talking about, you know, big schools come through where you can dang near walk across the river just stepping on the backs of them because they're so thick in there that's stuck, you know, top to bottom in the water column and throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, probably some of the more aware fishing groups would be like bow fishermen who are, you know, out on, you know, rivers like White River, Wabash, and some of the other bigger streams. Because they were the ones to first notice how, as you said, how they were schooling, and there were literally hundreds of bighead and silver carp in some of Indiana's rivers. The Wabash, in many sections, all the way up to Huntington and Fort Wayne, the dominant species is invasive carp. And in White River, they've made it all the way up to downtown Indianapolis. They haven't gotten past Broad Ripple Dam yet, to our knowledge, but there probably will be a flood when they get over Broad Ripple Dam. Then they're still going to have other dams, Noblesville and Anderson and so forth. But we've got silvers and big heads right in our own fishing waters here in the White River, especially.
Do you know any of the steps that, you know, the Indiana DNR and, you know, kind of what some of our local authorities are taking to mitigate the spread?
Well, the first thing was put up a lot of signs that said, do not take any bait fish from these streams. So you can imagine minnows look very similar. A carp minnow and a shiner and other fish minnows look very same.
Absolutely.
Similar. So it's not that common anymore, but people used to do a lot of seining in our rivers and then use those minnows in farm ponds, lakes, reservoirs, maybe take them to the Great Lakes. That's been the number one education project from the DNRs, is don't move bait fish.
So okay.
Do not seine bait fish and take them to another body of water.
Because you can never be 100%
sure
which minnow that is. Even though, you know, you might think, oh, it has that little spot, that one doesn't have that little spot. Sometimes it can just be an anomaly and that can set off a whole chain of events.
If you dumped, you know, 20 or 50 minnows, you could put them in Lake Monroe. You could put them in, you know, Geist. You could put them in wherever.
My gosh. Well, I certainly can't imagine, you know, just the stress of, you know, trying to pull out, you know, these minnows and, you know, sort through them, trying to figure out, you know, which one's a carp, which one's a shiner, and which one am I supposed to use?
Buy your minnows from a authorized bait dealer.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, how can we kind of as members and, you know, just as Hoosiers, you know, what can we kind of do to help, you know, mitigate the spread of invasive carp? You know, is it just, you know, really trying to kind of reach out to our local legislators and let them know that we do believe that this is an issue? Is there any way that we can kind of do some boots on the ground work? You know, what's our best approach?
There's not a lot of hands-on project work that IWF members could do, but supporting the continuing federal funding to develop these barrier systems to contain the spread is one. And that's literally about $25-30 million a year going towards these barrier systems. So supporting that through our local congressmen and senators is one thing. DNR is watching the tributaries. For example, Sugar Creek connects to the Wabash. We haven't seen carp move up Sugar Creek into our smallmouth waters, but everybody needs to be on the alert, watching for unusual looking fish with, you know, eyes that hang really low on the side of their head. You know, those are silver and big heads in any waters that you're fishing.
Got it. So it sounds like silver and big heads are the one that are really the ones that we're looking out for. And then of course those are distinguishable from our native carp.
Right.
And can you remind me what the names of the native carp are again?
We just call them common carp.
Okay.
Yeah. So what we call carp, which are, you know, the scales and the skin is more orange or yellow. The invasive carp, if you get one out of the water, you'll see that it is very slimy on the scales, and they bleed a lot whenever you handle them.
Really?
There's actually, you know, blood coming out around the scales. So if it jumps in your boat and flops around, you're going to have a bloody, slimy mess in your boat. So that's the other thing about safety. Besides threatening our native fish, boating safety is a big problem. In the areas where there are a lot of carp, it's really hampered, you know, water skiing or any other boating activities.
So, and I've heard of that, and I think I've seen, like, I don't know, there was a viral video that came out of, I think it was like one of Kentucky's agencies that posted a video where it was just a whole bunch of invasive carp that were just jumping up from behind a boat.
Yep.
Why do they do that?
The sound of the boat motor startles them. So it's the fear instinct, and they come out of the water. You know, a lot of fish, sometimes 20 fish at a time, will come out of the water as a boat passes. So, yeah, they're the most unusual you know, instinctively jumping fish that we've ever had in our waters. And they scare people because they really could smack you up the side of the head, could knock you out, could knock your teeth out.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I mean, they get up to, you know, 40, 50 pounds, right?
Well, 15 or 20 is more common, but they can get up to 40 pounds, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Still, well, yeah, I certainly don't want to take a 15-pound fish to the face if I'm just trying to, you know, go on a run down the lake.
Right.
That's for sure. And do all the species jump or just some of them?
Silvers are the primary jumpers. Big heads don't jump.
So. Okay. Okay. So we just got to look out for the silvers then.
Yep.
All right. All right. Well, John, you know, I really appreciate you coming on to the podcast today and being our first guest. Really enjoyed learning a little bit about invasive carp and I guess just kind of developing a better understanding of you know, why they're such a threat to our waterways and you know, the impact that they've kind of had. You know, here as we kind of wrap up, you know, what kind of final thoughts would you like to leave the listeners with as far as, you know, why they should care about this issue and, you know, why it should be something that should be a priority as we kind of, you know, go into another year where, you know, we have all sorts of things going on. You know, world certainly hasn't returned to normal. You know, why is this Asian carp issue, you know, so pervasive?
It's still the number one threat to our native fish populations in our rivers. And so even though we're not recreating that much on Indiana's rivers, the future is going to include using our rivers for, you know, outdoor recreation, I think. And also sport fishing, moving into the waters. It's very important for the future that we don't just write it off and say that's full of invasive carp, and we're not gonna stock fish. We're not gonna deal with what's happening in the White River, for example.
Got it. All right. Well, John, I know you're certainly a busy man. I don't want to take up too much of your time. So again, thank you so much for coming on, and for our listeners. For this series, we certainly plan to, you know, put out as much content as possible. We're going to be, you know, kind of establishing a little bit more of a schedule here as we kind of figure things out, to be totally candid. And we will certainly post on our social media to let you know when episodes will be dropping. You can find us on Apple Music / Apple Podcasts. You can find us on Spotify or wherever else you get your podcast. Certainly happy to have you tuned in and cannot wait to hear from you guys next time. Thank you so much.
It is estimated that we have lost over 60% of our global wildlife population over the last 50 years, making the Indiana Wildlife Federation and its partners essential. As the state-authorized affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation, we work with over 50 affiliates across the country to protect, restore, and connect fragmented and degraded habitat across protected lands, working lands, waterways, coasts, and communities. Through conservation education, advocacy, and on-the-ground actions like habitat restoration and sustainable trail building, the Indiana Wildlife Federation is making a difference from Indiana's natural resources. Join or renew your membership today to support our work and help inspire the next generation of Hoosier conservationists. Visit us at www.indianawildlife.org to support.